Subject tonight is sharp points. After some brief introductory material, we will discuss some sharp points that are found in present-day life with a somewhat expanded discussion in three areas. Examples of sharp points: biology, evidence for intelligent design, hubris, and the age of reason. So if you don't know what hubris means, you'll find out hopefully tonight. And then sharp points in the third millennium. It's only possible to cover the surface of these subjects. There's a reference list available here that gives some current books on these and other areas. Some of the books in the list are on the table before you, and you're welcome to speed read them if you like. If you get bored during the talk, come up and pick a book up and start reading it. First, what is a sharp point? A sharp point is the prick, pain, or confliction that a person experiences when he or she comes up against a truth about God or the creation order, a truth that conflicts with his own worldview. The origin of the term is from Saul's experience in the road to Damascus. It's hard for you to kick against the goads, Acts 26:14. We're particularly interested here in sharp points that occur when a person inquires into the nature of things in an attempt to understand the world we live in. The starting point for sharp points is the fact that God loves the inquiring mind. This love is displayed many places in the Bible. For example, in that well-known passage in Psalm 19, which says, "The heavens declare the glory of God." As a person probes diligently, whether it is in natural science or philosophy or in any of the many activities that make up life, God reveals himself. That is how the inquiry can have a redemptive slant to it. Proverbs 2, 3 to 5 states how God rewards diligent search. If you call out for insight and cry aloud for understanding, and if you look for it as for silver and search for it as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. The cascading of the words cry aloud, look, search for, call out, indicate diligent and persistent search. People who read a passage like this tend, I think, to give it a soft interpretation as God promising the warm reward of insight to his devoted followers. But there is a hard interpretation, too, as a promise to every person who searches out truth with diligence, whether or not that person is doing it as a matter of worship. Psalm 19 talks of a silent voice going through the whole earth. That voice is not just a secret reserved for a privileged few. It penetrates all creation. This proverb hints at a sharp point in the word fear. There is sometimes a tendency to translate this word, which appears frequently in the Bible, by the words awe or reverence. But I think that sometimes, as in Saul's case in the road to Damascus, the word of fear is not inappropriate. When a sharp point occurs, the observer may either accept or reject the implications of that point. I like E.M. Blakelock's imagery. You can doggedly hold on to your preconceptions, he says, or you can believe that a mind has ordered it all. A sharp point reveals a point of vulnerability in a person's position, but that warning can be brushed aside with effort. It's odd that some believers seem to be afraid of the serious inquiry that's implied in this proverb, as if knowing truth might somehow shake their faith. Francis Schaeffer remarked on this, "I often think," he says, that one of the reasons there is such an air of unreality in much of the church and for many people is that they do not understand what is really meant when we say Christianity is true. It's not merely true to a creed, though we should be true to our creeds. It's that Christianity is true to what really is there. What does it mean, Christianity is true to what really is there? We will consider shortly the fact that Christianity argues for the equal worth of all humans. Saying Christianity is true to what really is there means that this claim is not just arguing that Christians should be nice to each other, be humble and give deference to the other fellow out of some sense of Christian charity. To say Christianity is true to what really is there means that underlying these instructions for Christians is the fact that all human individuals really are of equal intrinsic worth, not just other Christians. This is what Dinesh D'Souza, one of the books we will discuss, calls the biblical teaching of passionate universalism. It is for Christians who believe that God has revealed himself in Scripture to investigate and proclaim the truths of Christianity that are really there. and not just to act and live our lives as though these truths are some weird tribal customs that we have handed down to us. That's the air of unreality that Francis Schaeffer refers to. Diligent search for insight and understanding leads to knowledge and fear of God. That is what the proverb says. As a Christian believer, I don't have to fight this. I don't have to scurry around to impose my particular slant on the interpretation of nature. I don't have to resort to force or bombast. I only need ask for a clear-eyed search for objective truth, speak truthfully myself, and let the results fall as they will. C.S. Lewis said this about the power of truth that is to be found in diligent inquiry. He says, "What I like about experience is that it is such an honest thing. You may take any number of wrong turnings, but keep your eyes open and you will not be allowed to go very far before the warning signs appear. You may have deceived yourself, but experience is not trying to deceive you. The universe rings true wherever you fairly test it." Perhaps Christians need to remind ourselves that Christ is also the Creator. So naturally, the universe rings true. The proverb promises that the honest inquiry into God's creation will be rewarded with fear and knowledge. This may not be what you were looking for. Serious inquiry can sometimes reveal flaws in your worldview. That's the nature of sharp points. C.S. Lewis said about his own conversion to Christianity, after a long struggle to maintain his scholarly atheism, he says, "The prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore the love that will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in, kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance to escape?" What C.S. Lewis doesn't say here is that the struggles were the result of his intellectual honesty, that he refused to evade inconvenient and uncomfortable lines of thought. In short, he searched diligently, as the proverb implies. The result was sharp points that he had to face, and they led in the end to his salvation. But the interesting thing is, God does not force himself on the inquirer. God will reveal himself, but the inquiring person can doggedly refuse to follow the evidence at the cost of pain and unsettling, or dishonesty. That is the point, so to speak, of a sharp point. The proverb and the witnesses we recited so far see God's creation as strangely accessible to the inquiring mind. I absolutely agree. Ponder this. Suppose the scale of things were two or three orders of magnitude different from what they are. Suppose there were no visible planets, or that they were so far away that they would not appear to be wandering stars. Would scholars ever have come to an understanding of the solar system? Suppose the laws of Newtonian physics were far more subtle than they are. Would Galileo, Newton, and the other empiricists have discovered them with their crude measuring gear? Let's be very specific for those who understand some physics. Suppose the wavelength of visible light were, say, 1,000 times longer than it is. That is, about a millimeter rather than a micron. Then it would be hard to see details in anything much smaller than the period at the end of a sentence, which is about, I estimate, about half a millimeter. Even an optical microscope would not help, because it cannot pick up details that are smaller than about half the wavelength of light. Would scientists have ever built the precision instruments available today without the stimulus of optical microscopes? Suppose that fossils never formed at all, so that we would have no evidence of the form of past living things. After all, fossils serve no biological function to the life that produced them. Suppose the geological column were so extensive that all we could probe in the Earth's upper crust was a single uniform layer of sediment and rock. Suppose the Grand Canyon only showed the topmost stratum. Would we then have obtained an understanding of geology? What would have been the inducement? The very accessibility of nature is a deliberate and gracious concession of God for the benefit of the inquiring mind, whom he reaches with silent speech and the line going throughout the earth, as Psalm 19 says. Through the medium of that silent speech, God intrudes with sharp points. Now I'd like to talk about the biblical basis for sharp points. Many sharp points concern assertions that are made in the Bible. As Francis Schaeffer wrote, these assertions tell us how the world really works and not just what our creed is. They speak to the whole of God's creation, not just to those who practice the biblical faith. I would like to note a few of these biblical assertions, which cover a broad range of human concerns. Concerning paganism, only God is divine, not nature, not rulers, not man-made idols. You might think in this day and age we wouldn't be worried about paganism anymore. Not so. About creation, matter is not eternal. Nature shows design. Humans rule over creation. That's interesting. Creation is sustained by God. About humanity, all humans are created in God's image, including male and female, incidentally. Evil comes from within. Objective truth exists, and there is a need for revelation. Concerning society, people have equal value, equal rights, different talents. Society needs a memory. We need history. We need wisdom. The nature of just laws. Just laws describe, they don't prescribe. And there is justice for the victim and the accused, not just for the state. Unfortunately, we won't be able to go into all of these areas, but we'll go into the ones we possibly can, and given the time we have. I would like to just note, Malcolm Muggeridge used the label Christendom to refer to a society that has respect for these biblical propositions. His lecture, The End of Christendom, laments the fact that modern society has lost respect for these roots. The false assumption that can be traced back to romanticists such as Emerson is that we can have the very real benefits of Christendom without keeping the roots. This is a false notion, as Muggeridge points out in his lecture. Later, we'll discuss scientific racism to illustrate the problems that result from the loss of society's roots in Christendom. In the absence of communication from God, how does one discover that there are no nature gods, or that there is no mysterious God called luck that guides the dice? Only by bitter experience of lost hopes and dreams. But it's very painful to discover an elusive truth, and that's one reason why the guidance of the Bible and the wisdom of long historical experience are important. To put it another way, the empirical method of discovery, which was so much the rage in science, is not always terribly useful. You may empirically discover the law of gravity, but if you do it as you pass the 35th floor in a free fall, the discovery doesn't provide much comfort or help. This loss of even an understanding of society's rooting in the past is one of the serious problems of modern society. The realization that the past has had its share of faults and myopia looms large in modern eyes, and everything is thrown out. The lessons one might learn by listening to the roots of the past have to be relearned. These lessons become bitter, sharp points. We will shortly discuss some of these, but first, let's start with the bright side of sharp points, ones that come out of the marvelous achievements of modern science. It's one of the amazing facts of the biblical creation account that God gave Adam the responsibility for naming the animals in Genesis 2, 19 to 20. To the Hebrew mind, naming things is very significant. It denotes authority and participation in meaning. And so the Hebrew reader would understand from this act that Adam actually participated in creation itself as a kind of assistant to God. I believe that the advances of modern science are a continuation of this gracious gift of participating in creation that God has granted to humans. It is not an accident that the scale of things is what it is, as we noted earlier. God is not an enemy of scientific advancement, but on the contrary, he revels in it. At the same time, he uses this very human creativity to reveal himself ever more sharply. I would like to mention a few examples. There's an embarrassment of riches, and so I want to spend more time on the last one, irreducible complexity, and so we'll just make some summary comments about the other items. Sharp points in modern science, the creation events, the finely tuned universe, the four impossibles in biology, which are the origin of life, gaps in the evolutionary tree, explaining human intelligence, and irreducible complexity. And some references are listed there, and since I'm going to take this thing off in just a second, you either have to write very fast or else you can come back later and look at it. The fact that the material universe had a definite beginning is today accepted in modern science. According to the best estimates, The universe began with a big bang some 12 to 18 billion years ago, and a huge explosion that has been expanding from the initial blast ever since. We can still detect the residual energy of that initial blast and observe the expansion in distant receding stars. What happened before the explosion is not known and is even unknowable. There have been all sorts of attempts to avoid the creation event, including theories of spontaneous generation of matter, of an oscillating universe that is currently on just one of its expansion phases, and so on. But none of these is generally viewed to be plausible based on the astrophysical evidence. The Big Bang beginning has profound consequences. It is not possible, for one thing, to credit matter with an eternal existence, which might allow it to have self-generating godlike qualities. Scientists must face the question, how did it begin? As well as the question, how did the universe develop to its present state in the limited time since the beginning? Both of these questions are things that many scientists would rather not be faced with, which is why there was considerable resistance to the Big Bang theory in the earlier parts of this century, until the evidence accumulated to the point where a few serious scientists now question it. Many astronomers have seen the obvious sharp point, that there is a God who transcends the universe and willed it into being. Others, perhaps most, remain agnostic, and relatively few, it seems, are out-and-out atheists, but perhaps this is risky to say. The psalmist marveled in Psalm 8 at the attention and authority that God gave to his human creation. What is man that thou art mindful of him? When the modern age of science began in the 16th century, the early scientists didn't have the data or the tools to see how profoundly significant man is in the universe. The evidence seemed to point in the opposite direction. Beginning in the 1500s, the findings of Copernicus and the other astronomers seemed to indicate that humans appear to be, quote, an unimportant bit of dust on an unimportant planet in an unimportant galaxy in an unimportant region somewhere in the vastness of space. The theologians and classical scholars protested in vain. In their protests, they unwisely tried to deny the clear evidence of science, and not surprisingly, they lost the argument. But as it turns out, the indications of human insignificance were false, and the theologians were right. Right, that is, in the proper area of their expertise, namely theology. In fact, the universe is extremely anthropocentric, and I'd like to just read a couple of quotes from some of the literature I've had here. As we look into the universe, this is Freeman Dyson, as we look into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked together for our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe must, in some sense, have known that we were coming. Another quote from Fred Hoyle, who was a Nobel laureate in physics, I do not believe that any scientist who examined the evidence would fail to draw the inference that the laws of nuclear physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences they produce inside the stars. I had one person ask me, what's the relevance of that to the finely tuned universe? Well, if we didn't have the elements produced inside the stars, we wouldn't have the elements that are in our bodies. That's the relevance, as if you get into the anthropic cosmological principle, you discover. The focus of the universe, vast as it is, on creating an environment suitable for human habitation, is the subject of Barrow and Tipper's excellent book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. It turns out that the apparent insignificance of humans in the vast expanse is an illusion. It is not only, he says, Barron and Tipper say, it is not only that man is adapted to the universe. The universe is adapted to man. Imagine a universe in which one or another of the fundamental dimensionless constants of physics was altered by just a few percent, one way or another. Man could never have come into being in such a universe. That's the central point of the anthropic principle. According to this principle, a life-giving factor lies at the center of the whole machinery and design of the world. The fine-tuning of the universe is a delicious sharp point of self-revelation by God. To pick just one of literally dozens of items available, consider the age and size of the universe. The usual notion is that billions of years are a long time, and that our present conscious lives are only a minute speck of the eons in time. Not so. What is missing from this notion is that 16 billion years, the approximate time since the Big Bang, is a very short time. In fact, it's the shortest time possible to have produced the world we live in today if it is done by the action of known laws of physics. It is as if God determined to use physical processes, but beyond that wasted no time at all in moving from the creation event to Eden. Here is the approximate time budget. First 4 minutes after creation, form hydrogen and primordial helium. There are two ways of getting helium. One is burning it in the stars from hydrogen, and the other is in the first 4 minutes there was a bunch made primordially. First billion years, form the primordial stars. Next 10 billion years, cook the basic elements of life, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen. Next billion years, form the solar system from the debris of the primordial stars. Next 4.5 billion Earth age, create the current ecosystem. Why so much time? Well, we got all this fossil fuel and all that sort of stuff that had to be created one way or another. And if you follow this kind of a scheme, then you say, well, if God created these things using normal physical processes, then this is the kind of time that's required. So it shouldn't be at all surprising if you believe that God used physical processes to get the elements and so forth and so on, that 16 billion years is about the youngest time you could possibly have. Therefore, the size and age of the universe, far from indicating the insignificance of our current era, points to a deliberate preparation for human habitation. Now, I would like to talk about the four impossibilities in biology, which I listed in the earlier slide, and I'll do them one by one, but because of time, I'm going to have to move, okay? Some of these have been discussed elsewhere, and I wanted to concentrate on the irreducible complexity, which is the fourth item. These are four areas in genetic and biochemical biology where living matter has achieved the impossible, meaning that there is no plausible scientific explanation to account for what the evidence shows, other than, well, it must be possible because here it is. Each of these areas is a source of great sharp points that demonstrate God's creative activity. There is no doubt that great discoveries remain to be made in these areas, and one should not just say God did it and stop further research, because God loves to have humans investigate his creation, and he honors honest inquiry. But I believe, based on what has occurred to date, that this inquiry will only sharpen the evidence for design. It will not point to purely natural, undirected processes as an adequate explanation. First, origin of life. Francis Crick, one of the discoverers of the configuration of DNA, wrote, "The origin of life appears to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to be satisfied to get it going. Mechanisms to explain the origin of life are almost totally lacking, despite the unwarranted hoopla that accompanies high school science descriptions of the original Miller-Urey experiments. There is a vast chasm between any such evidence of complex organic molecules and actual life. The evidence to support the theories for the origin of life is so meager and embarrassing that some biologists call the descriptions just so stories. The bottom line, after 40 years since the first Miller-Urey experiment, is that it results in the attempt to generate the precursors to life are uniformly unconvincing." Behe points out that in private, many scientists admit that science has no explanation for the beginning of life. At this point in our understanding of what is the minimum needed, the minimum turns out to be so huge that there is essentially no chance of its occurring naturally, at least as far as is known today. Ernst Mayr, one of the prominent biologists of the mid-20th century, says, and one of the originators of what's called neo-Darwinism, that a full realization of the near impossibility of an origin of life brings home the point how improbable this event was. This is why so many biologists believe that the origin of life was unique. The chances that this improbable phenomenon could have occurred several times is exceedingly small, no matter how many millions of planets in the universe. The next subject is gaps in the fossil record. And I won't say very much about that because it had been discussed in a number of other talks that we've had over the years, except just to quote the obvious conclusion. Everybody says, well, evolution has been demonstrated. And here's what one author says. The successes of the theory are limited to the minutiae of evolution, such as the adaptive change in coloration of moths. While it has remarkably little to say on the questions which interest us most, such as how there came to be moths in the first place. That is M.W. Ho and P.T. Saunders in one of the books that's listed in the reference. Regretfully, I can't say much more about these because I want to get to the last point. Human intelligence. In a previous talk, Beyond the Shadow of a Doubt, I remarked specifically on the question of human intelligence from the viewpoint of artificial intelligence. From a biblical perspective, the uniqueness of the human species is wrapped up in the fact that humans were created in God's image. The sharp points that derive from this involve evidence that consciousness and intelligence are phenomena unique to humans in the natural world, and that can be seen in three lines of attack: trying to emulate human thought, searching for the seat of consciousness, and questions regarding the evolution of intelligence. Regarding that last point, Barrow and Tipler, the anthropic cosmological principle, said this: intelligence has no a priori advantage. They're talking about evolutionarily. But it is a clear and unmistakable reproductive hazard. Wouldn't you like to know that? Having a brain is a reproductive hazard. In short, the evolution of cognition or intelligence and self-awareness of the human type is almost unlikely, even in the primate lineage, the monkeys and on up. The evolution of Homo sapiens is so improbable that it is unlikely to have occurred on any other planet in the entire visible universe. There is no indication in the geological record that the evolution of intelligence is at all inevitable. In fact, quite the reverse. Now let's talk about irreducible complexity. In 1994, there was a debate between Dr. Philip Johnson and Professor Provine of Stanford University on the topic, Darwinism, Science, or Naturalistic Philosophy. At one point during the debate, Provine showed a slide of a monarch butterfly. This is not the slide he showed, but this is a monarch butterfly, and stated his own position. He said, quote, "You cannot see evidence of intelligent design even in butterflies," unquote. Actually, he said, "a person who doesn't believe in creation," quote unquote. As I watched the debate on the video, the thought went through my mind, how strange and revealing that remark is. Looking at this photograph of a monarch butterfly, I see evidence for design. Am I naive? But of course, what that picture of a butterfly reveals is something that Darwin himself could have looked at. And evidently, it didn't convince him. On the other hand, Professor Provine knows a lot more than Darwin could have known about the butterfly. The external appearance that we see in the photograph is only the end result of an incredibly complex process. This external appearance hides vastly more indications of intelligence design than is apparent in the mere collage of color and structure that we see here. And yet, evidently, all this counts for nothing to Provine. Recently, a professor at Lehigh University, Michael Behe, wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. The point to his book and the reason for the title is that scientists now know vastly more about the biology of a cell and of microorganisms than was known in Darwin's day. The frontispiece to Behe's book shows this schematic of a bacterial flagellum. The fact that some bacteria swim by rotating their flagella rather than by waving them, as is true of other ciliated organisms, was first shown in 1973. This schematic shows a rotary motor in miniature, complete with all the essential parts that were invented for electric motors in modern times. Behe marvels not only at the design of this flagellum, but also at the complexity of the mechanism, both physical and chemical. How could this have evolved by chance through the process of small modifications from something else? Here we have the motor with the stator. The actuation is done by some kind of chemical reaction which causes the rotor to turn. And all that is in a size of 80 nanometers, which is about one-tenth of the wavelength of ultraviolet light, which we'll explain in a minute as a significance of that. As Behe posed the question, it mounts to a sharp point that shows evidence for intelligent design and creation. Is this enough to convince a person of intelligent design like Professor Provine? Well, I was convinced long ago, based on much less than this, so I'm not a good one to answer the question. But I doubt that Provine would have gotten quite the same number of knowing chuckles from the audience if he had put up this picture instead of the butterfly. Behe asserts that the bacterial flagellum is an example of irreducible complexity. In his words, this means, quote, "a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. Such a system cannot be got to gradually by a series of slight modifications." Behe notes that Charles Darwin himself was quite aware of the need for a slight successive modifications in his theory. In The Origin of Species, in a section headed Modes of Transition, Darwin made this statement. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organization existed, organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find out no such case. Darwin could look at the butterfly, and he did not find such a case. But he was unable to look at Fihi's example because anything substantially smaller than a cell could not be examined with the optical microscopes available in his day. Hence the title of Fihi's book, Darwin's Black Box. The black box refers to the cell, which was the smallest object that could be examined at that time. An optical microscope can only see something that is about half a wavelength of light, a visible light. As we mentioned earlier, this is about only a quarter of a micron for half a wavelength for a violet light. Only large-scale details of the bacteria would be visible, certainly not details of the flagellum's motor, which has a diameter 10 times smaller. So perhaps it's not surprising that Darwin could not find such a case as this. This clear evidence for intelligent design is an example of a sharp point. It points to a designer. And evidence for a designer points to God. This is the first step to redemption. He that comes to God must believe that he is. This example also illustrates that sharp points are not logical syllogisms. They do not lead to a conclusion in a mathematical sense. And so the implication of the sharp point can be denied at a cost which increases as the point becomes sharper. In the butterfly and the flagellum, one can see at least three increasing levels of sharpness. At the first level, there is the external appearance of the butterfly, its colorful appeal to the eye. As a believer in God, I can look about me in God's creation and rejoice in it and thank him for giving us such a beautiful world to live in. Daily I look about me and marvel at God's creation. I look at the butterfly and I recall Ecclesiastes 3:11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. An unbeliever looks around and sees accidental but felicitous geometrical patterns, perhaps the result of crystalline or chaotic growth, sees colors, the results of evolutionary processes that may have no particular function, or maybe use visual effects to enhance survival. This is a bit sharp, but perhaps not unbearably so, and this level is available to any thoughtful observer. At the second level, we have the cellular and genetic processes that underlie the external result. In my mind's eye, I see this level when I look at the butterfly. I see the complex life cycle, the caterpillar, the chrysalis, the adult monarch. But even below this is the cellular and genetic level, extreme complexities abounding. The more one knows about the physical, chemical, and cybernetic processes, and particularly about the logical complexities involved in the multiple layers of indirect action leading from the genetic coding to the final product, the more incredible these complexities appear. Where is the organizing principle? And what are the mathematical rules or physical properties that can yield these end results by mindless random processes? At the third level, we have the bacterial flagellum. The macro complexity here boggles the mind. If we do not have a designer, then how do these parts arise? By what ordering principle of nature would we get this? To achieve this end without a transcendent God would seem to give over to nature itself the attributes of divinity. Fihi argues effectively in his book that the flagellum is an example of irreducible complexity. It is reasonable to ask, why do we have to probe so deeply into the microscopic world in order to see evidence for irreducible complexity in design? Fihi points out in his book that when a biochemist works at the microscopic level, things are more transparent because enough layers of complexity have been removed so that theories can be tested by direct experimentation or calculation. It's almost possible to count the molecules. At the macro level, in which the evolutionists work, the complexities are so vast that it is relatively easy to gloss over the details. I recall something that Stephen Jay Gould wrote, disparaging the poor engineering of the human eye, arguing that if God had created the eye, he would have done a better job. This comment brought to mind discussions I had at Drexel when I was an undergraduate. When a real engineer criticizes the design of something, one can usually take the criticism to mean that he or she knows how to do the job better. Knowing how doesn't simply mean imagining a different end result. It means having an understanding of the process that leads to the result. I might imagine an old-fashioned suction-type well pump that would draw water from a 100-foot well. But in fact, that's impossible to do. Imagining something different or better doesn't count to an engineer unless he or she knows how to do it better. On the other hand, I can confidently state that neither Gould nor anyone else has any idea how to manipulate the DNA coding to produce a better eye. So his comments are not remarks of a person who has an eye for engineering. Lest I seem too harsh in my opinion, consider this remark by Behe on the subject. Many scientists think that given the origin of life, its subsequent evolution is easy to envision. The reason for this peculiar circumstance is that while chemists tried, you can imagine what he is, he's a chemist, try to test the origin of life scenarios by experiment or calculation, evolutionary biologists make no attempt to test evolutionary scenarios at the molecular level by experiment or calculation. As a result, evolutionary biology is stuck in the same frame of mind that dominated origin of life studies in the early 50s, before most experiments had been done. Imagination running wild. Biochemistry has, in fact, revealed a molecular world that stoutly resists explanation by the same theory so long applied at the level of the whole organism. Darwin never imagined the exquisitely profound complexity that exists even at the most basic levels of life. In the spirit of late breaking news, yesterday in the New York Times, they announced that we have just succeeded in completing the sequencing of E. coli. E. coli was one of the bacteria that would have had that rotating flagellum. The E. coli has 4,638,858 codons in the DNA, okay, that's pairs, which code for 4,286 genes. A gene then produces a protein or something like that, of which we know the role, or probable role, of 1,800 of them. So we have a little ways to go yet. Thought I'd just tell you that so that you, another little funny thing. You might ask, how do we know they rotate? Because they're so small, we can't even, you know. The way they show that a E. coli flagellum rotates is they glue the flagellum to a slide and watch the body rotate. Like taking a helicopter and holding the prop and watching. Now your next question is, somebody asked me this morning, so how do you glue the flagellum to the slide? I'm not going to get into that because I don't know. But I read about it, that there's some enzyme reaction that will cause that to happen. Anyway, now we'll get to some sharp points in other areas in science. There's a remarkable proverb, where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. That's from the New International. The King James Version is the well-known reading, where there is no vision, the people perish. I like the King James for the way it grabs one's imagination. But the NIV is actually a more accurate translation. It states very concisely what happened in the centuries after Gutenberg and the rise of rationalism. It expresses the need for God's revelation as a guide and restraint on human behavior. The age of reason spans the mid-16th to the mid-20th century. If you like to think in terms of specific events, dated from Nicolaus Copernicus, who first successfully challenged Ptolemaic astronomy, to Francis Crick, who discovered the helical configuration of DNA, the genetic code that exists in the cell. Why Copernicus? Because he challenged the gratuitous extension of religious authority to the natural world. The religious leaders naturally resisted this challenge. Luther, for example, dismissed Copernicus' statement that the earth spins by citing the account of Joshua's extended day, quote, "This fool wishes to reverse the entire scheme of astronomy. But sacred scripture tells us that Joshua commanded the sun to stand still, not the earth," unquote. The fact that Copernicus proved to be right and not Luther, or the Catholic cardinals for that matter, did not speak very well for religious authority, which lost heavily at the court of intellectual opinion. Why Francis Crick at the other end? Because with his discovery, biology lost all hope of fully understanding genetics, much less evolution, by empirical rational methods. The process is simply too complex. The multiple levels of indirect determinism that span the gap from the codons in DNA to the final realization in a functioning organism boggle the mind. The age of reason is over now, done in by numerous sharp points. The new age has not yet gelled. This is not surprising because, in fact, it took 100 years on either side of Copernicus for the groundwork of the age of reason to be set in place. And it will take some time for the new age to settle into a pattern too. Meanwhile, we call the New Age postmodern, for lack of a better term. The Age of Reason was the exuberant heyday of excessive credulous rationalism, of the scientific method, of logical reductionism, of the notion that everything of interest yields to the method of empirical science and can be picked apart and put back together logically and scientifically. The age saw the rise and fall of major secular isms, racism, Darwinism, Marxism, Freudianism, all which began in the hubris of enlightenment and died of their own inadequacies. This slide lists some of the recent books that record this demise. I say died. Actually, none of them is really dead. They're all still alive enough to cause a lot of trouble. They are lions, perhaps without teeth or claws, but you can still be gummed and pawed to death. From the Proverbs, it's evident that what this throwing off would lead to. If there is no revelation for a guide, and if the empirical methods of science are the only source of truth and knowledge, then society suffers two things. First, the only thing left is to look to oneself for hope. There is no revelation. Second, society suffers under the limited time horizon of empirical experience. Any lessons that may require a substantially longer time to learn, the lessons of tradition and wisdom gained over long years, are lost. We will now look at one example, the world dabbling in scientific racism. Unfortunately, we can't cover the others. I'd love to, but that's the way it goes. To begin with, it's important to distinguish between tribalism and racism. Tribalism, as the sociologists will have it, is an intense preference for one's own group, one's own relatives or relations. Racism is a statement of ethnic differences that are due, or group differences that are due to genetics. Tribalism is a bias in favor of one's own group, but does not necessarily imply that there's an objective difference between tribes, only that others are foreigners and don't belong. A current example of pure tribalism is the ethnic hatred between the Bosnians and the Serbs, who are racially indistinguishable. Racism, on the other hand, asserts that there is an objective inherited difference between cultural groups. That is, the empirical observables betoken a genetic otherness that separates human races. How do you explain the observed differences in cultures? There are two general explanations. The environmental explanation, that the differences are due to circumstantial accidents of life, availability of natural resources and climate, mobility, isolation from other ethnic groups, and so forth. And the race explanation, that the differences in cultures are due to genetic differences. Does the Bible say anything about this? Definitely yes. Consider this statement in Colossians 3:10-11. You have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Here there is no Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. The combination barbarian and Scythian here is parallel to the combination Greek or Jew. To the Jew of Paul's day, the name Greek brought to mind a person who, although possibly cultured, was religiously a pagan and therefore detestable to the Jewish God. Similarly, the Scythian is the archetypical barbarian, the barbarian of barbarians. Thus, Colossians 3:11 makes the emphatic point that even the, quote, offense which a Scythian must give to the natural sensibilities is overcome by the baptism of the Messiah Jesus, unquote, as one reference observes. Remarks about the equal worth of all humans occur in a number of places in the Bible, but this statement is particularly interesting because the equality among believers relates to the image of the Creator. It clearly indicates equal participation in the gospel and therefore equality at a fundamental level of all humans, at least all those who became Christians. This rules out, for example, the possibility that the barbarians or even the Scythians are subhuman, which has been a sticking point and the subject of many sharp points regarding racism from the Enlightenment to the present time. There is no room here for racism or for tribalism, for that matter. D'Souza calls this biblical teaching passionate universalism. D'Souza is the author of this book, The End of Racism, which is I think it's a great book. Secular culture of today teaches that racism is based on primitive, tribal, or especially religious prejudice, and that its elimination depends on the triumph of humanism and rationalism. In fact, the historical truth is exactly the opposite of this. Racism is a product of empirical science, developed and fortified during the Enlightenment, and its demise, together with the end of slavery, was initiated and is largely due to religious efforts based on biblical teaching and opposed by the enlightened freethinkers of society. D'Souza expresses the cultural situation in this way. Far from being ignorant and fearful, the early European racists were the most learned and adventurous men of the age, and their views developed as a rational and increasingly scientific attempt to make sense of the diverse world that was for the first time being encountered as a whole. Racism began as part of an effort to understand cultural differences among ethnic groups. As Europeans explored the world in the centuries after Columbus, they came across primitive and strange cultures. The question arose as to why many of these cultures apparently stagnated at a primitive subsistence level, while others had apparently advanced to a level of sophistication and then collapsed. They encountered social mores and practices that were offensive or seemed to display a childlike naivety. As these things were studied systematically, it became hard for the empirical scientists not to conclude that the differences between primitive and advanced groups had a genetic basis. Joseph Arthur de Gobineau, who was a prominent scientist in the mid-1800s, wrote the book The Inequality of Human Races in 1853, just 10 years before Darwin's Origin of Species. He argues, if environmentalism is true, why have some groups endowed with rich natural resources nevertheless failed to produce a comparable civilization to that of Europe? The equality of the races could be expected to produce a rough civilizational equality among cultures, Gobineau writes. Gobineau argues that the historical record refutes such expectations. Racism evolved into a scientifically based assertion of Western cultural superiority that was eventually proclaimed to be intrinsic to the white races and was used to justify slavery and domination of the Third World by Westerners. This message is the essence of D'Souza's book, and is one reason why the book is so disliked in some academic circles, because it points to the scientific method as a major culprit rather than to religious prejudice and superstition. Virtually all of the prominent scientists of the 19th century accepted these studies in racism, because in fact it was a triumph of modern science over old Greek environmentalism, as well as the passionate universalism of Christianity. It is interesting to see how modern humanistic scientists dance around this fact. In the book Broca's Brain, named after Paul Broca, a surgeon and anthropologist of the late 1800s, Carl Sagan felt it was necessary to find an excuse for this prominent scientist. He says, Broca was a humanist of the 19th century, but unable to shake the consuming prejudices, the human social diseases of his time. Broca, the founder of a society of free thinkers in his youth, believed in the importance of untrammeled inquiry and had lived his life in pursuit of that aim. His falling short of these ideals shows that someone as unstinting in the free pursuit of knowledge as Broca could still be deflected by endemic and respectable bigotry. Society corrupts the best of us. It's profoundly saddening that such prejudices were so extremely pervasive. The truth is, it was not consuming prejudices of society that was at fault. It was empirical science itself. But Carl Sagan, the supreme humanist, could not accept this explanation. In fact, Broca was very much in the mainstream of empirical science of his day, and it was less the result of prejudice than of blind faith in the powers of the empirical method and rejection of the superstition of the Bible. The issue of racism is a good example of why humans need revelation from God. Christendom's position of the essential similarity of human races had to suffer through almost three centuries of refutation by the quote-unquote Enlightenment before it once again took hold. The tale of scientific racism is a story of science gone wild. The newfound enthusiasm for the empirical method threw off all restraints, especially biblical principles. In essence, that is what the word freethinker means. The consequence is a terrible centuries-long history of humans perpetrating injustice in the name of science. The end was a double tragedy of scientific justification for treating the third world races as inferior to Westerners, and the scientific theories of Aryanism that fueled Hitler's ethnic cleansing. The world ended up being sickened by the consequences of its own vaunted free thinking. Where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. We do not have time to discuss other isms of science in the age of reason, of Marxism, Darwinism, and especially social Darwinism, Freudianism, and so on. Collectively, these isms have resulted in the age of extremes, as historian Eric Hobsbawm titled The First Half of the 20th Century, that book is sitting here, in which more humans were killed or allowed to die as a result of conscious, rational, scientific decisions than ever before in history. So Isaiah Berlin called this century the most terrible century in Western history. The two world wars of this century were profligate in the wasting of human lives, but they had the effect of showing the lie to the racism, social Darwinism, and other scientific isms. They graphically demonstrated that the prevailing secular viewpoint is woefully inadequate and leaves mankind vulnerable to untold devastations. They point to the need to consider something beyond the secular. But how many millions suffered and how much injustice in order to make that point? I recall reading of French priests who became atheists at Verdun, the focus of the most terrible battles of World War I. After observing the horrors of battle and deciding that no God could exist who would tolerate such a thing. But we will never know how many others then and since have been humbled to see that the war was not a parable about God, but about secularism, and turned to God as a result. Now I'd like to turn to the future and talk about sharp points in the third millennium. And I'd like to talk about a couple of these areas at least, and depending on how the time goes, we might actually get all the way through, but I don't know. It's risky, of course, to talk about the future, and most especially about what God is going to do in the future, and so the following remarks about the third millennium should be taken with a considerable pinch of salt. I should like to say something about the following subjects in which I feel strong sharp points lurk. The Malthusian world and God's sustaining activity in the world. About Aaronic science, about elitism, and about the nature of just law. And there are references there that I'll mention as we go. And if you need to see this slide afterwards, copy the references down. I think all of them are sitting here at one place or another. First, let's talk about the Malthusian world. It's probably news to nobody that the present mood in society has an undercurrent of turmoil, anxiety, and discontent. At the same time, it is also evident that the world is in much better economic and ecological shape than was confidently predicted a few decades ago. The laws of Malthusian gloom appear to have been suspended, at least for the time. The world is not in a state of devastation resulting from nuclear holocaust. It is not facing industrial collapse stemming from the loss of fossil fuel reserves. It is not experiencing runaway inflation. It is not in the midst of mass starvation caused by an exploding population that has outgrown its food supply. It is not in the grasp of a global totalitarian dictatorship. Some of the fears that exist today can be traced to junk science. The books by Aaron Wadofsky, Ronald Bailey, and Philip K. Howard focus on these fears and the facts behind them. In contrast, the fears of 50 years ago were solidly based in reasonable expectations and sober thinking. The literature of that time, such as Brave New World, 1984, Animal Farm, Dr. Strangelove, On the Beach, was not based on scientific fancy but on conditions that actually existed. There were terrorizing and suppressive dictatorships on a massive scale. There was an out-of-control arms race toward pending nuclear holocaust. There were contemporary cases of mass starvation and of populations wildly outstripping food supplies, and known fossil fuel supplies were diminishing. These were not the result of some computer model predicting exotic scenarios. Finally, the whole world had just gone through the second horrendous world war in less than two generations, which ended in a crescendo of military firepower. Who would predict that there would not be an even more horrendous repetition in the next two generations? In the face of these demonstrably real disasters waiting to happen, I can hardly imagine anyone in 1940 or 1950 looking ahead to the year 2000 with anything but foreboding. Even the optimists worked under a sense of impending disaster. The contrast between then and now could hardly be more stark. The gloomsters of the present have an ever more Cassandra-like appearance as things continue to truck along in relative calm. The only real problems that exist today are generally recognized as solvable ones that only, exclamation point, require political will. 50 years ago, it was as if the world were on a roller coaster with no one able to control the fate that the future would bring. What's happened? At the risk of getting myself into serious trouble with some Christians who only see the unremitting prospect of doom as consistent with biblical prophecy, what I see is God's gracious sustaining activity at work. I do not think that things are wonderful, but I believe that the state of the world today is due principally to God's gracious providence. It says in Colossians 1:17, in him all things hold together. I believe that very strongly. Let me tell you how strongly. The gloom and doom predictions after World War II were not wrong. They were, in fact, right. In contrast to this realistic gloom, the Pollyannish millennialists of the late 1800s were indeed wrong. Their utopia was the result of the much ballyhooed progress of science and of human self-effort. A revealing example of such utopian vision is Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, 2000 to 1887. This novel is set in Boston in the year 2000 and describes a placid communal society perfect in every way. The bitter tragedies of two world wars thoroughly extinguished such visions on the part of authors of the late 1940s. The gloom and doom predictions after World War II were based on solid and reasoned appraisals of the state of things at the time. Similarly, the responsible environmentalists who see today's ecosystem as fragile and unstable are right. If you look at this speck in the universe that God picked to create life and ultimately to create humans into which he invested his own image, it looks like an exceedingly precarious place to invest such an effort. Surely Ptolemy's scheme of the Earth-centered universe is a much more stable and secure place in which to perform such precious work. If you look at the years over which God prepared the world for human habitation, your gut inclination would be to say, couldn't you have picked a better place? This leads to a sharp point. I believe that the world we live in is in reality a precarious and unstable place, not just physically, but economically, politically, and in every other way. I do not believe that as we learn more and more about this world, it will become more understandable and therefore more controllable. In fact, that's the message of the junk scientists. Spend more money, we can do it. On the contrary, the stability that the world experiences will become ever more inexplicable. I see a future in which as we learn more about the world around us, we will see less and less cause for calm and complacency, because we will appreciate ever more keenly how truly tenuous is our hold on the third planet from the sun. But I also see the appreciation dawning that it's totally beyond our ability as humans to affect this in any substantial way. To some, this will lead to ironic living and self-delusion. To others, it will lead to God. I see a future in which governments are led down the primrose path, trying to control the world to make it a more stable place to live. We will spend vast amounts of money and squander vast amounts of effort, and will end up with about as much uncertainty and instability as we started with. A good prototype for this is the war on poverty, in which America has spent about $4 trillion with little to show. That's a sharp point. I'm not arguing that we should pay no attention to the environment or other potential perils, but I am saying that draconian efforts will be expensive and unavailing, and we will never be able to calm the fears of those who can see with clear eyes how perilous is our perch in the universe. The very stability of the outcome in the face of the instability of the prospect is a sharp point to those who heed it. It points to our dependence on the providence of God. Now, I'd like to talk something about ironic science. The term ironic science is John Horgan's term. John Horgan wrote the book called The End of Science to describe the state of science and philosophy in the future. Ironic science results from science that is based on speculations that cannot be empirically verified. Ironic philosophy is philosophy based on the notion that there's no such thing as truth, and that if there is, there's no way of knowing it. This is the essence of philosophical reductionism. A remarkable number of recent books lament the coming of this age of ironic science. Irony and paranoia go hand in hand. A paranoid is a person who is an exception to his own worldview. He makes himself a god, standing above the mundane world. As John Farrell notes, Farrell wrote the book Freud's Paranoid Quest, he makes himself a god, the paranoid does, standing above the mundane world. Freud's a good example of a paranoid. But if you live in a world in which there is no such thing as knowable truth, then paranoia is the way to advance your own agenda. You make yourself an exception to your worldview. Lynn Cheney marveled at academics who, on the one hand, argue that everything is relative, that there is no such thing as truth, but then insist on being believed themselves. John Horgan's book laments the fact that all the easy stuff of science has been or soon will be discovered. The book basically consists of interviews with many famous modern scientists and philosophers, with the general conclusion that most of science is heading toward the ironic state. Physics is reduced to speculations on superstrings and other exotic explanations for the material universe that are totally beyond any experimental testing. Biology is coming face to face with ever starker evidence of what we are discussing as its impossible, and which Horgan sees as an impenetrable barrier to advancement. Philosophy has hit the dead end of reductionism. Farrell basically argues that Freudian psychology was always fraudulent, and that's becoming increasingly clear. What's happening is that since the beginning of the age of reason, as the enlightened view of science came to pervade all of society, the world has operated in the belief that there is a sharp demarcation between the religious and secular spheres, and that a wall of separation could be maintained between them. This is nonsense. But the fact is only now gradually becoming apparent. The world described by these scientists or hoped for by these scientists never really existed. There never was a time when science existed apart from philosophical and religious ideas. We see irony and the resultant paranoia at work in much of academia today, and it's spilling over into politics and the media, where lies and fabrications are increasingly treated on a par with facts and truth, and reported with the same deadpan so-called media neutrality. As Lynn Cheney points out, much academic argument has abandoned reason and logic and moved in the direction of political bombast and power-based coercion. Truth is a victim in the process because truth is irrelevant. People who insist on accuracy are fact fetishes or have an excess of literalism, as George Stephanopoulos once complained. There are several sharp points in play here, which will become more and more apparent as science and culture proceed in the coming millennium. One is that the so-called wall of separation between secular science and religion will be seen as a myth. Clauser, who wrote the book The Myth of Religious Neutrality, and Horgan are both talking about the same phenomenon. Both are saying you can't talk about science or philosophy without bringing in gratuitous assumptions. Horgan calls these assumptions ironic. Clauser calls them religious. This is an important sharp point that will come to play in future years. If the sharp point is heated, society will eventually see the fiction in the wall of separation. If reason prevails, the result should be greater acceptance of religious instruction and morals and the religious content of science in general. If reason does not prevail, the result will be an ever starker breakdown in education, science, and social policy. Science will head towards politics and power, towards irrationality and away from reason, resulting in further painful sharp points. Ironic science is a reality, but it should not be cause for despair, except for those who are unable to accept the fact that religious assumptions pervade everything we do. Learning that lesson is itself a very positive step back toward a reasonable balance between religion and secular science, a balance that science has failed to attain when it threw off the influence of religion and tradition at the start of the age of reason. Elitism is akin to racism. And one of my topics about the third millennium was talking about elitism. It can take many forms, but it's at root a belief that certain strata of society or people have certain qualities, talents, attractive features, for example, and have a right to be served or provide leadership for the rest of society. The belief in divine right of kings or in other sorts of inherited privilege is a form of elitism. The deference given to highly educated people over others is another kind of elitism. The paranoia that results from ironic sciences is another kind of elitism, in that it places the paranoid person over everybody else. The Old Testament is full of statements that condemn the pride of the social elite, which all too often leads to hardship and oppression of those who live in humble circumstances. It is no accident that the prophecies of the coming Messiah depict him as coming not from Jerusalem, but from the laboring class town of Bethlehem. In addition, Isaiah depicts the Messiah as having no regal bearing or social stature that would be a mark of status or royal patrimony. Jesus himself catered to people of humble circumstances and made a point of associating with social outcasts such as the publicans and sinners. He pointedly accepted people whom the religious leaders rejected, even the despised Samaritans, whom he depicted in the parable of the Good Samaritan as having greater sense of neighborliness than the priests and Levites themselves. Again, these stories, parables, and his actions were sharp points designed to get his audience to do some self-examination and return to the principles of equality that were, in fact, embedded in the law, even though lost in the practices of some of those who claimed to honor it. Justice Bork, and Lynn Cheney both argue that the American government is distorted by an academic hegemony. Rather than being ruled by the Constitution, Bork argues, the courts rule by the whims of the academic elite. The institutions of higher learning, which are breeding grounds for trashing American values, are for the most part subsidized by the very American taxpayers that they trash. Elitists who call themselves artists, consider themselves above the law, and produce outright pornography, including child pornography, that is protected as art, but some of which would be illegal for a private citizen to own. Government institutions such as the Academy of Science and the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities provide money and subsidies to continue this cult of elitism. The sharp points that come from elitism are well described by these authors. They are found in the disasters of socialism, in public education, the legal system, and in other areas of society where elitism has held sway. It's hard to predict what the end result will be, whether progress will be made against that elitism, or whether the entrenchment of elitists with money and power that goes with it will continue unchecked. Finally, I'd like to say something about the nature of just law. The Bible has a lot to say about the nature of just laws. I believe that the coming millennium will bring into sharp focus the contrast that now exists between the biblical views and law as it is practiced in our society. If changes are not made in our laws, then our society may face terrible sharp points. I will mention two conceptual differences between our current laws, which are based on the Greco-Roman model, and the biblical law. First, the biblical law is descriptive law, whereas this Greco-Roman model is prescriptive law. Second, in the biblical law, the victim is the focus of justice, not society as a whole. We will discuss each of these points briefly. First, on prescriptive law. The social laws of the Old Testament were very few in number and concerned sweepingly general principles of conduct. The Ten Commandments, to give one example, would fit on just one of the tens of thousands of pages of regulations in the Federal Register produced each year. The Old Testament principle at work here is that laws should be general and not specific, descriptive and not prescriptive. I discussed this distinction about it and its implications for society in another report, God's Law, Creation Law. As Philip Howard states in his book, The Death of Common Sense, the modern objective is to make, quote, a system of laws where all is set forth precisely, each situation covered in advance, and this comes directly out of the Enlightenment. This is the ultimate of prescriptive law, and as Howard points out, this ideal is impossible to attain, and in fact leads to arbitrariness in its application. The essential moral problem with the non-biblical Greco-Roman approach to law is that it leads to the abandonment of common sense, as the title of Howard's book asserts, and it leads to a general disrespect for the law. Justice is not served by drawing fine legal distinctions that are totally artificial, such as the distinction between late-term abortion, which is legal and can be performed for any reason, and infanticide, which is murder. Thus, a young woman who aborts a child for any reason, just before birth, acts within her rights and is entirely within the law. But a woman who kills her newborn child is a murderer. It is perhaps understandable that the woman herself cannot see the distinction, since it would take a sophist who is thoroughly immersed in legal distinctions to understand it. Similarly, it is patently nonsensical that a woman who endangers her unborn child by excessive drug or alcohol use is a felon, but one who aborts it is not. These kinds of distinctions in law breed disdain for the rule of law. Trivialization of common sense leads to disdain for the rule of law. This is the source of a number of sharp points. Concerning the identity of the victim, an important contrast exists between modern law and biblical law in identifying the wronged party. The modern concept is that a fictitious entity, the state, is the injured party. A crime is viewed as an offense against the state, disrespect for its authority or disregard for its regulations. The biblical concept is that the victim is the injured party. The purpose of the state is to ensure justice for the victim, not to protect its own majesty. Roy Clauser notes the following: where the authority of the law is viewed as generated by the state itself, it is easy to see all criminal acts as offenses against the state. So our laws assume that the state is the injured party in criminal actions. The state receives any fines imposed, any property confiscated, and is considered the party to which any term of imprisonment will count as a debt paid. This view serves to guarantee that the real injured party, the victim, will remain uncompensated for losses sustained. Clauser goes on to say that the proper role of government is to act as the bearer, not the creator of the authority it wields in enforcing justice. It must act on behalf of the citizen, not on behalf of its own offended majesty. And that ends my discussion of the third millennium. So hopefully the Lord will come before then anyway, so it doesn't really matter, right? You can ignore everything I just said. In recent years, there have been remarkable numbers of books whose very titles tell us that the comfortable era of science and progress that we have enjoyed over the past 50 years is about to end. I recently looked at books in print because I was curious about how many books I had read or heard about in connection with my interest in sharp points that have titles that begin with the words the end of or the death of. Here's an edited list of what I found. These are taken out of some 5 or 6 pages of titles. I only kept listings that seemed to imply some commentary on the state of things in society. The list seems pretty impressive to me. And note the increasing numbers each year, going from 1992 to 1997. By the time the millennium comes around, we should have a really impressive list. I don't know exactly what this means. Let's just read some of these titles. The Death of Big Brother, Death of Chaos, Death of Character, The Death of Common Sense, The Death of Inflation. Okay, well, that's a good one. The Death of the Church, The Death of Affirmative Action. Of course, the death of the church has been predicted for centuries now. The End of Affirmative Action, The End of Capitalism, The End of Economics, The End of Education, The End of History, The End of Racism, The End of Science, The End of Welfare, and so forth. The End of Work, that's a good one. I think that this quotation from Malcolm Muggeridge summarizes what I've been talking about tonight pretty well. He says, all creation, even our sins, everything that happens, all doing and considering, a leaf falling, a nuclear bomb exploding, the total experience of living individually and collectively carries God's messages as if it were encoded.